prepare to experience the strongest radio allowable by law. Secrets will be revealed. Myths dispelled. From the studio gym where excuses never apply, it's Superhuman Radio with your host, Carl Lenore.
It would help if I opened my microphone, right? Welcome back to another episode of Superhuman Radio. This is an important show. I've been touting this show all week long for a reason. And it's not just about fibromyalgia. I'm going to make some claims on this show today that are going to create some question even about diabetic neuropathy. Because I don't believe diabetic neuropathy is a result of rising blood sugar levels. I think diabetics have gut issues, and the neuropathy that they feel is a type of a hyperalgesia, and it's in the same spectrum as fibromyalgia. And I have reason to believe this very, very strongly. And I wanted to do a show about fibromyalgia because more and more people I talk to are suffering from it. And I met someone on Ken O'Neill's show recently that I had the luxury of producing. And that's Angela Atkins. How you doing, Angela? Oh, well, hold on, Angela. I'm behind my game here today. How you doing, Angela?
Hi, Carl. Thanks. I'm doing great. Great to talk to you again.
While you were on Ken's show, while we didn't really focus on fibro, you mentioned some things about fibro, and I was like, oh, my God, she's like actually in the same wheelhouse I am about this. So before we start talking about the fact that it is possible to live without fibromyalgia, and it's not a flip of a switch, it's not a pill, you know, it's not something because it took years. By the time fibro symptoms show up, you have wrecked your body for years. And so it takes years to get back. But let's talk about your story first and how your journey started. So you were actually in computer IT, right, originally?
Yes, I was working for a very prestigious organization in their IT department when I discovered that my health was just declining to the point that it was everything I could do just to go to work every day. I would drag myself out of bed, go to work. And again, IT can be very stressful, especially if you're working with users, because you have to put on that game face and get out there and solve their problems. And everybody's problems is their most important one. And so every day it was taking all of my strength, all of my energy. And I'd come home and I'd literally crash every single day on the couch. My poor husband would just wake me up and say, hey, do you want to eat something? And I'd get up, have something to eat. And then I'd go to bed and I'd repeat this cycle for about 5 years. It was a cycle that was a mere existence. I really wasn't living. I was just existing.
So would you say the early symptoms of fibro are this constantly exhausted feeling? Was that the earliest or were there other things? Did you sleep disturbances? Did anything else change even before that?
Oh, there was a multitude of symptoms, but the first one that I recognized was the extreme exhaustion. And a lot of times when people are diagnosed with fibromyalgia, chronic fatigue is also tossed in there. Now, back when I was diagnosed, fibromyalgia was like the catch-all phrase that they used. They didn't know what was wrong with you. You felt this pain and you were tired all the time and it looked like you had what they call adrenal fatigue.
Right.
And they just compounded all those things together. So because of that, you get the diagnosis of fibromyalgia. And what they want to do is just put you on medication. Now, at the time, there wasn't the medications that they use now. Now, I think the most popular one is like Lyrica that they prescribe.
What about low-dose naltrexone? Wasn't that a real breakthrough for fibro patients?
Not at that time. I mean, this is going back 10 or 12 years.
Okay.
So it really wasn't actually at the time that I was starting with the diagnosis, not many people really knew what fibromyalgia was. There weren't studies on it. There wasn't a whole lot of information out there. So it was a lot of trying to piece things together for myself. So I would start with one doctor who would say, I really don't know what's wrong with you, but let's get you a checkup because I'm so weak. Maybe it's pulmonary. So I'd go to a pulmonary specialist and he would say, no, I don't really see this, you know, as your primary function. Maybe you have a weakened heart muscle. We'll send you to a cardiologist. And I do all the specialties for, you know, each one of them. And I just went from doctor to doctor to doctor. And the only thing I wound up with was a handful of prescriptions.
Yeah.
And so I was taking all this medication on top of feeling so poorly, and I don't think my body could process it because my honest feeling is your body was not meant to process chemicals. It just doesn't know how to do it properly. And they just go out there and it's like a nuclear blast. Whatever that drug is supposed to do, it just blasts it out in your body. And when you're weakened and your immune system is compromised and you're already feeling as bad as you possibly can, putting all that on top of it, I didn't think helped at all. And so it took me quite a few years to go through the discovery process. But in the process, I did realize what was wrong was my nutrition. And it all boiled down
to
that.
So here's an interesting thing that I've noticed. People with fibro, they'll talk about good days and bad days, mm-hmm. but very rarely do they ask the question, what did I do yesterday that created a bad day today? Because usually that's what happens. You do something on Wednesday, Thursday you feel terrible. Maybe even Friday you still feel terrible, depending on the hangover from it. Very few of these people, and men get fibro too, by the way. This is not a uniquely female thing. Yeah. Many of these people never ask themselves, what did I do yesterday? What did I eat yesterday that could have triggered this? Do you notice that?
Well, I do notice that. And I actually ask my clients not to wait till the next day. It should be an immediate thing because 9 times out of 10, they'll have a reaction to something, either to something they ate, a toxic substance they're exposed to. And toxic can be any number of things. It could be something that they breathe, something they put on their skin. It's how their body reacts to it. If their body doesn't like it, it's toxic to them.
Right.
And there are levels of toxicity. But I ask them, don't wait until it all falls apart. If something happens and you have some semblance of a reaction, make a note. I ask them to journal it. I ate a specific food and now I feel terrible, or I have a raging headache, or, you know, within 24 hours, some other symptom appeared. So if you wait too long, you lose track of what it is that's causing this reaction that your body is going through. And I think all these reactions are based out of our gut. I mean, if our gut isn't healthy, we're not healthy.
Fibro starts in the gut. It is from leaky gut. It's from metabolic endotoxins getting into the bloodstream. And, you know, the problem with metabolic endotoxemia is depending on your predisposition, your weak link tissues, but also the metabolites that are escaping into your bloodstream. So if you're a big grain eater, if you're a big sugar eater, different things get into the bloodstream. Those molecules target different tissue. Thyroid tissue gets attacked from this particular metabolite. The nerves, the long nerves in the leg get attacked from this particular metabolite, and so on. And so the problem is, we are dealing with metabolic endotoxemia that takes on different symptoms. So everybody's got a different disease. No, they all have the same thing. The way it presents itself in person A and person B is different. But what do you think about that statement?
Well, let's just back up a second. If you think about it, if you respect food as providing nourishment to your body, and many people, and I believe, food is medicine. But ultimately, what food is doing is providing information to your cells. So if you give your cells the right information, the food that you're feeding your cells through, you know, ingesting it and digesting it in the gut, if it's good information, your body's going to work and function properly. If it's bad information, meaning you're eating food that is not right for you, then the cells don't know what to do. They misfire. the function is abnormal. And that's what leads, I think, to all these other symptoms. And because each person has their own unique biochemistry, that's why it manifests itself slightly differently in every person. So you don't necessarily see exactly the same thing. You may have a cluster of symptoms that look like the same thing. But ultimately, what it is that person's biochemistry is reacting to whatever food provided that information that can't be processed properly, and it comes out in some other form. For me, it came out in pain. For the most dramatic symptom that I remember is I would take a shower and it felt like needles piercing my skin. Mm-hmm. And I never heard that before from any, but then later as I did more studies, it's like, oh, that's not unusual, but it's not typical. Right. And so when you get people going to a doctor saying, I have this symptom, they don't know what to do with it because it's not documented somewhere. It's not documented that, you know, X number of people will get this particular symptom. Therefore, the diagnosis is. And so it's very difficult to track down something like fibromyalgia. What really needs to be done is address, OK, what are all the upstream factors here? What have you eaten? What have you, you know, what have you been exposed to? I mean, just simple exposure to pesticides can trigger this kind of thing. So I think we need to look at all those factors combined rather than saying, oh, well, you have some abnormal pain symptoms. So here's a pill. We'll fix the symptom. That doesn't really fix the root cause. And what I'm about is looking as an integrative health coach, I'm looking at combining where people are, which is usually the conventional model, and getting them more to a functional model where they're looking for the root cause. And that only can be done when you really start addressing where all of it begins. And it begins in the gut.
So I want to illustrate the accuracy of something that you just said, and that is that if you're not eating the things that are right for you, because a lot of people think that that's a lot of hubbub. You know what I mean? Oh, come on. And especially when you have idiots like Larry the Cable Guy telling people, when the food you love doesn't love you, take Nexium. No, when the food you love doesn't love you, don't eat it. It doesn't love you. It wants to hurt you.
Exactly.
But I want to illustrate the accuracy of your statement. Just this morning, I'm talking to a friend who's getting ready to go to Vietnam on vacation. And she was telling me that they told her, don't even brush your teeth with the water. Don't eat anything that isn't completely well cooked. And we're going on. And so I said to her, why don't Vietnamese people get sick from eating that food? And why? Because they have become acclimated. Their microbiome has become acclimated to that. So here's an example. Now, we can all appreciate that. We all know when we go to Mexico, don't drink the water. So why wouldn't you believe that some foods are good for you and some foods aren't?
And, you know, it is proven that we all have different needs. I mean, scientifically, we know that. But most people have been sold the bill of goods that this food is healthy and this food isn't healthy. Right. And so they try to eat in those parameters. And it doesn't work for everyone. It just doesn't. What I try to impress upon people is that we have our own, what I call a nutrition prescription. You should treat food like medicine. It's your own prescription. And because of that, you need to discover what uniquely works for you. And rather than listening to all that, you know, media hype and commercials and everything, you have to discover what is healthy for you. And in order to do that, you really need to go through a very prescriptive way of eating. And that's basically what I work with my clients. I'm also coming out with a self-paced course where people can learn to do that themselves. And that way, you don't have to pay a doctor to kind of figure out, well, what do all these symptoms mean? Well, you'll know. Because we'll go, you know, you can go through it yourself and say, oh, when I eat this food, I get this reaction. When I eat this food, I get a better reaction. Put all that together and you come up with your own unique nutritional plan. And that's really what people need to do. Diets don't work. Diets really are not for, they say diets are made for the average person. Do you know an average person?
No, I don't.
I don't.
No, no.
We're all unique.
Right.
And that's the whole point. That's the whole point.
Why do people who suffer from, maybe I'm wrong. This is my assumption, so you can correct me. It's my impression that people who suffer from fibromyalgia crave sugar. Am I wrong about that?
I think many do, and I think many don't know that they do because there are different ways to crave sugar. It's not just that refined white stuff. I went through this with my husband. He didn't have fibromyalgia, but he craved a lot of salty foods. But then when we broke it down, they were still all refined carbohydrates, the crackers, the chips, all those refined carbohydrates break down quickly in the bloodstream into sugar. So you're getting the exact same metabolic effect. You're getting an uptick in glucose. Therefore, your brain gets that reward signal. You know, the sugar triggers the dopamine centers in the brain, which we now have studies that prove it's just as addictive as if you were taking heroin or cocaine. So we're getting this constant reward signal. So we want to repeat that. And it's very unconscious.
While I agree that sugar has an addictive quality, the only people who think it's as addictive as heroin and cocaine are people who haven't done heroin and cocaine. I say that with all deference to your experience, but I have done both, and I can tell you that sugar is easier to kick.
Now, if you look at a brain scan.
No, I get it. The reward centers light
up.
Yes.
The same areas.
Yes.
Yeah.
No, I get it. But whenever I hear that, I chuckle a little bit because anybody who's ever done cocaine knows.
I don't think you can compare them, you know, apples to apples.
Right.
They're really different substances and they do different things to your body.
Right.
But the fact that it's hitting the same receptors in the brain means that it is has addictive properties. And what is happening is sugar is a free drug to us, basically. I mean, it's available everywhere.
Yes.
And we don't have to go and purchase it illegally. We just get it every single day in all the foods we eat.
Right.
So we just keep repeating that process.
Right. So the leaky gut, which I remember about 5 or 6 years ago, I had a doctor on the show, and I said leaky gut, and he said leaky gut is a myth. And I wasn't intelligent enough about the topic back then to come back. If you have GERD, you have a leaky gut, just for the record. That's an example of leaky gut. It's leaking through a valve up into the esophagus. The esophagus isn't designed to absorb food, so it gets into the bloodstream. But leaky gut really is domino one for the process of developing fibromyalgia years later, is it not?
I think it is. I personally think in my own experience and the experience that I've had with clients who've gone through similar things is if you're eating food that is not suited for you, like for me, I have celiac disease and I only discovered that after a long journey to getting to where I am. But that was kind of the light bulb for me that this really was a gut issue. That every time I ate gluten, it was going in and doing a little bit of damage to my small intestine every time. Now, the great thing about the human body is that it is a true miracle that it can repair itself over and over and over again. But how many times can you do it before it really starts to break down on its own? So if you do it for years and years, and most of the standard American diet would be something like getting up and having a bagel in the morning and then damaging that small intestine, because what it's doing, it's going into the gut, and there is a group cell membranes that are tightly formed together, and they have these what are called villi on them.
Like
think
hair.
Of it like a shag carpet.
Yeah.
And then they have smaller microvilli on top of that. Well, that's to filter out all those particles of food. So you have very small particles passing through. What happens is when you have something like gluten coming in, it wears down, it scrapes against that shag carpet type thing, and it wears those villi down, and eventually it breaks through that cell membrane so the junctions aren't tight anymore. And so those food particles, not only gluten, but other ones, can pass through into the bloodstream and create a toxic environment. And for me, that came out of celiac disease, and when I had the actual endoscopy to look at it, there was already lesions on my small intestine. So it was a done deal. I knew
right.
I had it.
Right.
And for people like me, it's easy to say, well, I'm never eating gluten again. Well, it's just not that. That's the problem. People think, oh, it's just the one thing. It could possibly be many things. But anything that affects your gut is going to cause a problem somewhere else in the body. Because really, all health really surrounds the gut.
Yes.
If you have an unhealthy gut, you're going to be unhealthy.
Absolutely. You know, the immune system is the gut. And the greatest example of how well the immune system works, that echo will go away in a second, I think, is the fact that we can eat a piece of meat and it doesn't poison us. Our body extracts what it needs and passes out what it doesn't need. And the fact that we can eat food is in fact an example of the immune system at work. When the immune system starts to fail, it's because the gut is failing, as you point out. The barriers to keeping, you know, I had a doctor on recently who said that the gut is not controlled by the brain. It has its own brain. It has its own system of operation and timing. And, you know, we talk about gut motility. That none of that is controlled by the brain. It's all controlled by the gut. The gut, while it's inside of us, it's a separate system entirely. And as a result of that, it is actually our operating system. You know, you're a computer person, right? So DOS is your operating system. If DOS doesn't work, none of your software works.
Exactly.
So your digestive system, your gut, your immune system, that is your operating system. And once that gets fouled up, everything starts to go haywire as a result of it. And what I said at the beginning of the show, I truly believe, because I know people who have neuropathies that don't have diabetes. And I know people who have neuropathies that have diabetes. I don't think the neuropathy is a result of the sugar. I think most diabetics have really, really messed up guts.
That's probably very true.
And I think
it would be interesting because I think if you resolve the gut issues, which would mean obviously reducing their glucose anyway, because a lot of the gut issues are going to be, you know, exacerbated by that, that you'd see them not only become overall well, you know, their overall wellness would improve, but I think their diabetic condition can be reversed. I really do believe that.
I do, too. And I actually I know it's accurate. I want to take a break. And when we come back, I want to talk. I want to go back a little bit and talk about how long it was that you were starting to get symptoms. And then once you started to make the changes necessary, how long before these maladies started to subside? How's that sound?
Sounds good.
Plug your website before we go into the break.
You can find me at yourhealthunbound.com.
So if you're listening to the show and you want some guidance, that's where you go. Stay tuned. We'll be right back.
Move over, superheroes. This is the Superhuman Channel.
Welcome back to Superhuman Radio. Today's guest is Angela Atkins, and we're talking about living without fibromyalgia. I have to put this up. This is actually the younger brother of one of my closest friends growing up in New York, Paul Albano. He said that he lost 65 pounds. I know it's not about fibro, but I got to give him props here. His A1C was 11.5. Cholesterol was 250. He was a mess. To date, he's at 200 pounds. His A1C is 6.4. His cholesterol is under 200. He's proof that if you lose weight, you can reverse diabetes. And this is important, too, because just like fibro, the medical orthodoxy likes to think, make you think that once you've got diabetes, you're stuck with it and you're going to be on meds for the rest of your life. It's just a lie. It's just a lie. That's all it is. Getting back to the whole fibro discussion. So what span of time would you say in years was it that the malaise and chronic fatigue came on before you really hit the wall?
Well, you know, because it's insidious and it starts out very slowly, and you don't think that you're getting sick necessarily. You just feel kind of run down because you're working hard, you're under a lot of stress. But I noticed my husband is a lot younger than I am. He's 15 years younger. So, I try to keep up with him. And we were going to the gym a couple of times a week. And I just noticed I couldn't do it anymore. And he would say, come on, you know, like push through, just kind of encouraging me. And I just, there wasn't one more in me. Right. I just couldn't get myself there. So over the course of probably 2 or 3 years, I noticed this decline until I hit the wall where literally there was no more. And I just said, I there's no gym, there's no nothing. I just can only do what I have to do. And for me, it was I had to work. If I didn't even have to work, I probably wouldn't even done that either. It was a slow decline. But when you hit bottom, you know it. Your body has no more reserve. And so for me, when I hit bottom, I felt awful. I mean, it didn't feel like I was sick. Like I didn't have the flu or I didn't have some, you know, disease that I thought needed to be cured.
Right.
I just felt exhausted all the time. I just didn't feel right. And then when the pain sensation started getting worse, and I'm like, why is everything hurting? I mean, it hurt to get dressed. So, I mean, there were days that getting dressed meant slipping on sweatpants because I couldn't stand, you know, buttoning things up. It's all you can do sometimes just to do the minimum. So it was over a progression of probably 2 or 3 years that I finally got to the point that I'm done. Something is wrong with my body.
Okay, hold there. 2 or 3 years. How long were you involved with doctors trying to find a solution in years?
Oh, longer than that. Because during the beginning part, I began questioning, was there something wrong? You know, just having regular blood tests and nothing was showing up. Probably towards the end of like 5 years, I had already seen maybe a dozen different doctors. Mm-hmm. And I was taking about 20 different prescriptions.
Oh, gosh.
So my body was completely off balance. And and this is what I tell my clients, you have to advocate for yourself. And if you can't do it because you're too ill, then you have to find somebody to advocate for you. And fortunately for me, it was my husband. He was able to work with me. I would say, this is not right. I'm not strong enough to really, I didn't have the resilience to keep coming back. And he was with me every step of the way. So I was very fortunate. And for people who don't have that, I always say to them, if you're my client, I'm happy to be your advocate. I'm happy to teach you how to advocate for yourself. Because what you ultimately need to do is stand up to a doctor who only understands, and this is not every doctor, and I'm not condemning doctors.
Right, right.
I certainly love my doctors, and I respect their years of training. But as far as chronic illness goes, the conventional model doesn't address chronic illness correctly. They look at it from the acute symptoms. Well, it doesn't work. You know, giving me a pill to kind of temper that symptom doesn't get to the root cause.
Right.
And it's only until you get to the root cause will you actually get better.
Yeah, because you're still living broken. And then
exactly.
And by the way, I said this on yesterday's show, and I want to repeat it today. But 300 or 400 years from now, they're going to look back at this period in time, and they're going to look at what the pharmaceutical industry has done to the population today. In the same way we look back at the 1700s when they used to draw and quarter people and set their entrails on fire and drag them through the streets as barbaric, they're going to look at this and they're going to say, my God, what were those people thinking taking all those pills?
It's so funny. I just said something very similar to my husband this past week. Like, we are going to be the dark ages of medicine.
Yes, we are. Really, there's no doubt in my mind about it. And you know, people need to snap out of it. Okay, so once you realized, okay, I got to start working on and finding ways to heal my gut, how long did it take before you started to see symptoms changing? Because it doesn't happen quickly. You got to stay on that road for a while, right?
Honest to God, within 6 months, I began to feel different.
But see, most people won't wait 6 months. If they don't see they literally, in 2 days, I don't feel any different. I'm going to do something else now.
Right. Well, we're used to that pill. Give me that magic pill. Make it happen instantly. And it doesn't happen that way naturally. And we're not meant to do that. You didn't get to the condition you're in a day or two. It did take years. And whether or not you realize it, if you know, whatever condition you develop, no matter what it is, cancer, diabetes, it's been happening for years. You just get that diagnosis yesterday.
Right.
That doesn't mean it wasn't happening. So for me, and I'm a very tenacious person, I know I've made this commitment to myself. I spend years reading, listening to every lecture I could find, sorting out the fact from the fiction. What is nutrition? What is, you know, what does healthy really mean? And when I finally put it all together, I was very tenacious about it. I said, I am going to do this. I am going to create what I, at the time, I called it my optimal nutrition plan. I'm going to figure out what works for me. And I didn't vary from it for a year, for a solid year. Every day I journaled exactly what I ate. I made sure if I had reactions, they were noted in my journal. And what was happening is I wasn't exercising. I wasn't even walking because I was so ill at the time.
Right.
And I lost 55 pounds and got better.
Wow.
So to me, nutrition is the key.
Oh, it always is.
The key.
Ask any competitive bodybuilder and he will tell you or she will tell you what you do in the gym is 10% and what you do in the kitchen is 90% of your results.
Exactly.
That's the God's honest truth. Okay, so there are some definite offenders out there I want to touch on. You pointed out grains a second ago. Grains are really hurting our population today. But do you know who Dr. Anthony Samsell is?
No, I'm not familiar with him.
Dr. Samsell received 1,100 emails between Monsanto and the CDC through the Freedom of Information Act, and has compiled a series of studies now from their data.
Mm-hmm.
You know, not so.
Right.
And he's been on my show several times. He's about to come back on again because they are actually finding glyphosate in the fluid in discs, in the fingernails of people with scleroderma, in semen. We know about breast milk. They're finding glyphosate everywhere today. It's really.
Exactly.
And, you know, it's scary to me. This is scary to me because Monsanto may have actually, not forever, but for a considerable period of time, like really kind of destroyed the environment for a while with glyphosate.
Well, I think there's going to be residual effects for a long time coming.
Yes, and we don't even know.
Our soil is so bad. I mean, it's going to take years to recover.
Well, what they're now just starting to examine is the transgenerational epigenetic effects of glyphosate. These studies are being done right now. They're looking at rodents 2 and 3 generations to see what happens to sperm germ cells and so on. But not even that. Let's forget that for a second. Let's forget all of that for just 1 second. Glyphosate is an antimicrobial that works on the shikimate pathway in soil. They don't think humans have the shikimate pathway, but we do. But it's in our microbes in our gut, not in our cells, in our microbes.
So the very part of us that is most of us.
Yes. Because I said to Dr. Daniel Lieberman, the author of The Story of the Human Body, he's a Harvard professor and he teaches anthropology. I said, you know, the more I read about this, the more I realize that our microbes needed hands to pick food and feet to become
exactly.
Ambulatory. So we really serve them. We're serving everything that's living inside of us. And he laughed and he agreed.
Right.
So here's the interesting thing. There is a patent that Monsanto has right now on glyphosate and amoxicillin combined together as a combined antibiotic. Because what people don't realize is the difference between an antimicrobial and an antibiotic is the dose and the duration. That's all it is.
Hmm.
And glyphosate is a known antimicrobial. It says it in the first patent that they ever said that it's an antimicrobial. So when you consume this stuff, it causes a lot of the problems you're talking about with the tight junctions opening up, with the mucosal barrier eroding and allowing the actual tissue to be exposed to the food that's passing through. So,
and actually being able to pass through into the bloodstream.
Yes, that's where the fibro starts. When that stuff passes into the bloodstream, the body sees it and goes, wow, what's that foreign agent? Send the immune system to attack it.
Exactly.
And it just
and
happens
where
to look.
That's where we get autoimmune.
Yes.
That's exactly what's happening.
And that molecule just happens to look like your thyroid tissue. So it goes, well, while we're killing this, let's kill the thyroid too.
Right.
Okay.
And most women especially, I know it happens in men too, but most women especially, if they have fibromyalgia, will most likely have thyroid issues. And many of them will have Hashimoto's, which is also autoimmune.
Yes, because now at that point in time, the immune system is attacking everything. It's gone crazy.
Absolutely.
So what are your thoughts?
So many things shut down. That's because your body is so busy attacking itself, it doesn't have the reserves to do with what it needs to do.
So what are your thoughts on should all grains, as a rule, be removed from anybody dealing with fibromyalgia, or are you not even willing to say no? They've got to figure that out on their own.
Here's my personal philosophy.
Because there's glyphosate on all grains today. It's on all grains.
Well, I'm totally grain free personally. I don't eat any grains. I don't care if they say they're organic or not. I have celiac disease. Not only does gluten bother me, but I also have a wheat allergy. So on top of that, anything that's grain related is going to cause some sort of problem, partly by the molecular mimicry, meaning my body thinks it's one of those offenders. Is it wheat or is it gluten? So it's going to attack that anyway. So I just eliminated completely. So when I have a client that has something like a condition like fibromyalgia, I will say, we're going to remove all of the known allergens. I take out grains. I take out dairy. I take out soy, processed foods, artificial sweeteners, sugar. All of them come out. And when I say grains, I include corn. because people don't think of corn as a grain, but it is.
Yeah.
And once they're off of all that, and most people like, oh, what am I going to eat? And there's plenty of food to eat. And we come up with something that works for them. But within, I would say within a week, most of them are saying, hey, you know what? I feel better today. Mm-hmm. They may not be 100%, but there's a noticeable difference because they're taking those offending items out of their gut. I mean, it's almost simple that people don't realize it. If you put it in your mouth, it affects your entire body.
Yes. Yes.
It doesn't matter.
So
if you put it on your skin and it's transdermal, it means it's going to go through your skin.
Right.
It's going to affect your entire body.
So give that list again before we go into the break, right? All grains and even corn, soy.
All grains and
dairy.
Corn. Dairy. Now, I'm specifically cow dairy because that's the most common one that's an allergen for most people.
You know why that is, but you know why that is, right? Because they feed cows corn and grain. See, what people don't realize is the animals you eat, you get what they eat too. They tested eggs and they found gluten in eggs. Well, how did it get there? Because they're feeding the chickens grain.
Well, here's the thing that I want to tell people to remember. When you get that wonderful advertisement that says, oh, our whatever product is hormone free, and they're all vegetarian, they're fed vegetarian. They mean corn.
Yes.
They don't mean what you and I mean as vegetarian.
Right.
So you're still getting either the glyphosate or the allergen portion of that, whatever it is in corn that's going to affect you. So I always say, don't do it. If it's got any kind of hint that it could have something that's an allergen, for the short period that we go through to see what works with their body, just take it out. So that's grains, including corn, soy, all dairy that's from a cow, all processed products. I mean, anything that's got any kind of ingredient in it that's not a natural product. And if it's got more than five ingredients, I always tell my clients, don't buy them at all. It's just not worth it.
Right.
Something whole is what you want.
Right.
Any kind of sugar or artificial sweeteners, they all have to come out.
Right.
Now, for people who have very serious autoimmune conditions, like I consider fibromyalgia, I also take them off of peanuts, pistachios, because they can be very moldy and people don't realize that. And it's going to depend on where they're processed. And the average person's not going to do all that research.
What about mushrooms? Everybody's looking at mushrooms now and going, wait, maybe we need to rethink these. They're a fungus.
Again, that depends. It's not one of the ones I normally take off, but
okay.
I'll go a little further here. So after they're off of the peanuts and the pistachios, I also take them off of legumes. Now, if somebody has a nut allergy, of course, they're gone also. But then we go a little bit deeper. If they're still not getting well, meaning they've gotten all the allergens out, but they're still having symptoms, then we take them off of nightshades. And that includes things like tomatoes and peppers and eggplants.
Eggplants, yeah.
All these things can have some sort of contributing factor to keep that autoimmunity going because of the potential allergen properties.
What's the old saying about poison? It's in the dose, right?
Yes.
Right? So people don't realize this, but there's several poisonous nightshades.
Oh, absolutely.
That just have more concentrated the things that nightshades have that they used to use back in the old days to kill people. Well, guess what? Tomatoes are a nightshade. Eggplants are a nightshade. So if you believe that the poison is in the dose, then taking a little just make you sick. It won't kill you.
Well, there's also some thought on that. It depends on where you are. If you are really compromised, a little may start causing some harm. What I try to do is get my clients to the other side where they've gotten rid of everything. And as we begin adding back what they can have, we see at what point does it cause a problem, and then you scale back. Some people opt for saying even a little bit is not good for me, so I'm just taking it out. I had one client who made her own bread, and she bought the best flour and all the ingredients. And then she discovered going through my program that it was indeed that bread that was causing her symptoms.
Wow.
So when she got rid of it, she didn't have symptoms anymore. And I said, okay, could be the grain, could be all the other things, because yeast can cause a problem for certain people. So you really have to go through every single thing. If you are severely compromised, you should be willing to give yourself that time investment to find out what is causing your problem. Get to the root cause. Find the answer. Then you won't question it anymore. Right. And it's so simple to build a healthy diet around the foods that don't compromise you.
I want to take a quick commercial break. When we come back, I want to cover two topics. Something that you didn't list that I'm very suspicious of that everybody consumes today. And then
okay.
The obvious question, a lot of women are going to go, as you point out. I mean, I had this discussion with a guy recently who suffers from fibro type symptoms. He's got hyperalgesia. I said, it's fiber. Mm. And when I told him about, he says, but I love pie. So I want to talk about that, you know, what am I going to eat syndrome that people start to think of when we come back. Stay tuned. We'll be right back with more Superhuman Radio.
You're listening to the Superhuman Channel. Don't hate us because we feel good.
Welcome back to Superhuman Radio. We're talking today with Angela Atkins, and this is a really important topic. Because I'm telling you, folks, there's a lot of people out there who have symptoms that they're not calling fibro, but they're in the same. You know how spectrum autism has become a spectrum? Because they're like, well, there's this type and there's this type. Well, there are a lot of issues out there. And it could be fibro. It could be Hashimoto's. It could be Addison's. It could be rheumatoid arthritis. The list goes on and on and on. It could be neuropathies. It could be neuralgias. And they're all the same disease. I should say condition, because they're reversible.
Yes, they're all conditions that have the ability to be reversed. So I like your thought. I think we should call them an autoimmune spectrum.
Yes.
Because that's really what they all are. They are attacking the body.
Yes.
And so in order to reverse that, you need to remove the offenders. And I wanted to, before you go and ask me those two questions, I wanted to say what's the caveat about removing things. Depending on what the client comes presenting with, I also ask them to remove eggs and caffeine. So it's going to depend on the individual. It's not like an all or nothing for everyone. So, I really do personalized coaching.
We're going to get to we have a viewer question. We'll get to that in a second. Now that you said that, I want to inject what I wanted to say.
Okay.
I suspect that coffee is causing a lot of gut problems today. These boutique coffees are not only high in caffeine, which has been shown to have an effect on the vagus nerve's control of digestive motility, as well as the esophageal sphincter system.
I think a lot of GERD comes from that.
Yes. But more importantly, when my mother used to drink coffee, it was a little 3-ounce cup of coffee, and it was clear. You could see right to the bottom of the cup. Today, when you drink a cup of coffee, there's almost topsoil in the bottom of it. And you know what that means? The stuff that's settling to the bottom, that's staying in the cup, but there's stuff that's staying in the coffee that you're drinking. Those little particles have to be irritating the stomach. They have to be. And I'll tell you what, 99% of us drink coffee the way we learned to smoke cigarettes. The first couple times we smoked it was like dying, but we worked hard to overcome it. When you first start drinking coffee, you go, oh my God, I'm burping, I'm belching, my stomach is burning. But I got to work through it because I want to drink coffee. No, don't drink it.
It's the same way with alcohol. Yes. I mean, when you're young and try alcohol, you're like, oh, this is horrible. But it's that socially acceptable thing. The same way drinking coffee every morning. I think I need it. And then you get in that habit. And then your body needs caffeine. And then you go through this process of putting up with symptoms that shouldn't be there simply because you've developed either an addiction to the caffeine or just a dependence, whatever it is. But if it's not serving you, why keep doing it? I don't understand it.
I have abused, my audience knows this, I've been on the air 12 years. I have abused caffeine on and off for over a decade now. And when I say abuse, there are days where I use up to 1,500 milligrams of caffeine supplements on top of drinking coffee. Okay? So I now am 2 weeks off of all caffeine and coffee. This morning I went to the gym and I texted the love of my life, Elisa, and I said, I feel so good. Clean living is the best. you know, it takes a little while to come off it. You talk about sugar being a drug. Caffeine is a drug.
It's
folks.
A psychoactive drug. Absolutely.
And the nation has, because I was talking to a guy this morning about sleep. And I real fast, I said, you know, the deep dive in sleep is down here. This is where you should be during the day. So it's easy to get there. But most of us are up here between social media and caffeine and lifestyle and everything. So when we do the deep dive, we only get to here. We never get down into that sleep. Well, I believe strongly that coffee, these boutique coffees, are causing a lot of problems with people's guts today. You have any opinion on that?
I do. A lot of my clients who come that are coffee drinkers, we spend more time dealing with getting off coffee than we do almost anything else. I actually think it's harder than sugar.
I agree.
It's become a crutch. They have to have the, it's like smoking used to be, had to have the cigarette in your hand. It was that whole tactile, have to have that coffee cup in your hand. And it's that whole, the behavioral process that goes around it. And you just need to start piecing this thing apart, getting it down to its, you know, micro levels and realizing for what it is, and then learning to let go. And then once people do, it really becomes, oh, you know what? I didn't feel gassy, or I didn't feel
bloaty or anything. Yeah.
Yeah. And I'm like, okay, now that you know what that feels like, are you willing to go back to that? And usually because they've gotten to that point after a long struggle, because it's not easy for people to change their minds, then that's the biggest thing. Getting your mind wrapped around these changes is the hardest part. Doing it is actually easy. Physically doing it is easy. Getting your mind wrapped around it is difficult. So once they've gone through that process, they're less likely to go back. And that's what I find is that's success to me.
One of the components of addiction, of drug addiction, is the euphoria that you feel when you start to think about copping. When you think about, I was a product of the 60s and 70s, so it was popular to use drugs back then. And I also studied some, I had some psychology courses in college. And one of the things we talked about was addiction. And what I learned about it was that the junkie gets excited just thinking about going out and scoring. The excitement is euphoric. It's almost as good as the actual obtaining the drug. Well, Starbucks and Seattle Best, all these companies have done a fantastic job in creating that phenomenon. You walk into that place, you're seen by people, you can't wait to walk in and blah, blah, blah. And they've actually played upon the fact that getting the drug is as exciting as using the drug. They've capitalized on that, in my opinion.
Exactly. And for many people, that whole act, the same way as we eat, we start to salivate. We see food, we start to salivate. That begins that whole process. It begins to, like, our mind clicks on to, oh, we're going to have this great food, and you know what it tastes like. And so you start to experience that. The problem with things that are drugs, like a psychoactive drug like caffeine, is that sometimes you get to the point where the amount that you take is not enough. So then you have to increase it to get that effect. And so not just seeing it, but now you have to act on it. And then when you act on it, you have to continue the act on it because you're not getting the reward. So the reward may be diminished now just by seeing it. But yes, I agree. It is just like a junkie.
Here's a snapshot of the addict mind, because that's me, right? I'm addicted to working out now. So it's a better thing to be addicted to. But so this morning I woke up, and it was the first morning in 2 weeks where I woke up and I actually felt really good. And
awesome.
I had no coffee, no tea, no caffeine supplements. And I was thinking to myself, man, I feel so good. I can't wait to get to the gym and train. I opened my supplement drawer, and there was a bottle of 5-Hour Energy sitting there. And I thought, I'd probably feel better if I took half of that. That's the addict's brain. If I feel good this way, then I'm going to feel even better with more. And then when I take more, I'll feel even better with more. And that's the alcoholic and everybody else. They do the same
thing. And as I said, it is the mindset that they get into. And we all have different mindsets. It's not just the addict. I mean, we all have our particular ways of eating. And it's the way we associate all those things that makes it either a pleasurable experience or not.
Right.
And we play those over and over in our head. So if we want it to be pleasurable, then we need to do the same action over and over and over again, whether that's having the coffee, eating the candy, having a cigarette, having a drink of alcohol, whatever it is, we need to keep repeating that behavior so we keep reinforcing that mental model and we keep getting that dopamine rush. We keep getting that high from it.
Yes. Okay, so this next question actually segues nicely into the discussion I want to have now. So Michael LaPelt, who's a longtime listener of the show, says, any opinions on organic spelt and oats? But before you answer that question, this question is born in the valley of, I don't want to give up all this stuff. What am I going to eat if I have to give up? Because, you know, I mean, granted, he likes organic spelt and oats. But the reality is, if you say, look, no oats, that means no oats.
It's all a question of what you're willing to commit to. For me, my commitment was all in. Some people can't do that. Just because something says it's organic doesn't mean it's good for you. I see all the times ingredients on the label, on ingredient labels that says organic cane sugar. It's still cane sugar. Yeah. It's going to do exactly the same thing as non-organic sugar. Yeah. So it's a question of what you're willing to let your body have. If you have no reaction or your body's not being adversely affected by grains, I'm not saying you need to take them out. I'm saying for my clients who come to me already compromised, we take them out to find out if they are an issue. And if they are, then my goal is to have them understand that they make the commitment, not me. They make the commitment to how far they're willing to do it. I tell them what I do. My experience is if I go back to eating any kind of grain, I'm going to have some digestive distress. Am I willing to risk that? My answer is no. What's your answer?
Right.
So that's what it comes down to.
Well, and there's another phenomenon that's taking place. We did a show a couple of years ago about what acellular carbohydrates do to the microbiome. So acellular carbohydrate is any flour. Once it's reduced and processed to that level, it acts differently in the stomach than if you would eat it. So you know, you have like everybody's like, oh, but it's tapioca crust. The pizza's made with tapioca crust. And it's still a flour. It's still acellular carbohydrate. It's not going to be good for you. It's going to cause you problems. It's not going to cause you celiac maybe response, but it's going to cause you some other problem. Acellular carbohydrates are not good to eat. Any flour is not good to eat.
Well, this is what I always say. Just because it says it's organic or gluten-free or non-GMO or whatever it is, it doesn't make it healthy.
Right.
What makes it healthy is if it works for your body.
Mm.
So I don't care what you ask. It doesn't matter. If it doesn't work with your unique biochemistry, then you have to accept the risk of doing damage or causing some sort of adverse outcome. I personally, and in my practice, I advise my clients, let's not go there because we already know what it's done to your body. Most of the time, I won't say I get 100% compliance because people are different. Most of the time, people are compliant because they like the way they feel.
Right.
So if you're not willing to give up something, and here's for me, it's not giving up. I don't say, oh, you have to give all this up. I say, let's transition. So instead of eating bread for your meals, we're going to make lettuce wraps. Or instead of eating, you know, a certain food, we're going to have an alternate for you that's going to satisfy you in the way you eat. It may not have the same taste, but it's going to satisfy you. So you need to change that mental model. What does a sandwich look for you? Is it two pieces of bread with a piece of meat inside? Well, we're going to change that mental model. We're going to put some sort of protein that your body can handle inside of a wrapping that you can eat like a sandwich. It's going to be crunchy because it's going to be a vegetable. For me, I might make my sandwiches out of sweet potatoes, but not everybody has to. What I'm saying is we can find an alternative. It's just, are you willing to accept it? Are you willing to make that commitment? And the commitment is to themselves, not to anybody else. Are you willing to commit to yourself?
What is the recovering autoimmune spectrum person?
I like that.
I know. We created that on the show today.
Yes, what is the, let's put that out there.
Yeah. What does the recovering autoimmune spectrum individual do when they have to be sociable and go to a restaurant?
Well, I always tell them they're paying for that meal. So the people there are working for them. So if you can't eat something, you tell them. You say, I have an allergy to whatever. Like when I go in, I tell them I have celiac disease. I can't have anything that has any product that has a grain in it. I'm very specific. I also know that I don't go to fast food restaurants. I don't go to casual restaurants. I go to upscale restaurants. Mm-hmm. Now, not everybody wants to or can afford to. My choice. I go there. I'm paying you for what you deem your product is worth. So you need to make for me what I can eat. If they can't do it, I can get up and leave. That's my choice. 9 times out of 10, and maybe 10 out of 10 so far, I've had pretty much, I'm trying to think, locally we have some really great restaurants, and I tell them that. The chef will come out and talk to me mm-hmm. and say, tell me what you can eat. And then he customizes what I can eat. I've never been dissatisfied. But you have to be willing to do that.
Well, you also have to be careful. A lot of times the wait staff doesn't know. So, for instance, here's something I learned recently. One of my favorite restaurants, their blue cheese dressing, has some sort of wheat thickening agent, some roux in it or something. A lot of times, like when I travel on business and I go to a hotel and they have that uniformly same color sheet pan of scrambled eggs that I know that can't be scrambled eggs because there's no scrambled eggs that's all the same color like that. And I say to them, did this come out of a box, carton, or a bag? And of course they say yes. And I say, and then I've had some people in restaurants get mad at me. I say, can I see the ingredients? You know, and they have to go to the refrigerator case and they have to get this big box and bring it over to me. And sure enough, there's soy protein in them. You know, there's all these things that I don't want that. And I've gotten to the point where anytime I see those scrambled eggs, I don't even look at them. I just walk past them now.
Well, the simple thing that I do, and I've had this experience when I was traveling, is that I just go to whomever's in charge. If there's somebody who's working, you know, that buffet setup or whatever, I say, I have serious food allergies. I don't want to get sick here in your hotel. Can I get a couple of real hard-boiled eggs?
Yeah.
And they go and they do it because they don't want you to get sick in their hotel.
Yes.
So you just ask them and you put the onus on yourself. I don't want this to happen. And I don't want this, you know, I want this to be a pleasant experience. Well, they want it to be a pleasant experience for you too.
Right.
So, again, it's taking your own responsibility.
If you're new to this whole concept of reversing your fibromyalgia, you really do need some stewardship. You need someone to help you, to guide you. You can save a lot of time, avoid the pitfalls, not make the mistakes if you work with someone like Angela Atkins. And I would imagine people don't have to work with you forever. It's kind of like going for a class. Once you get it down, then you're on your own, and you do your own thing.
Yeah, that's my goal. I work with people. I mean, it depends, again, on their severity of their health. Some work for 3 months, some work for 6 months, some come back, do longer. As I said, I'm coming out with a self-paced program in just a short while to do the same thing that I do with them as a private client, that once you discover what it is that works for you, you just build that habit. It's just building muscle memory and building a habit and just making it a lifetime plan. It's not a diet. That's the whole thing. People think, oh, well, I'll just do this while I'm working with you. No, this is a lifetime commitment.
Right.
You're committing to your health for a lifetime. And we're always evolving. So you have to have that skill. So sometime in the future, if something else happens, you're able to say, oh, okay, I need to revisit this plan because something else changed. Maybe I need a different choice. Maybe I need to make another decision. And so you have those skills when you've finished the coaching. And so you can do it on your own. It becomes your method of taking care of yourself for a lifetime.
Plug your website again. I have one last question.
Okay. It's yourhealthunbound.com.
And I hope those of you out there who are suffering with some of these issues reach out and get help, because those drugs you're taking are not doing anything good for you. They may be masking the symptoms, kind of like the smoke alarm goes off. Do you run out of the house or do you take the battery out and sit back down and watch television? Because the drugs you're taking, it's like taking the battery out and sitting back down and watching television and staying in the house while it's burning down. Your body's trying to tell you something. Don't ignore it. Where does exercise and activity fall in with the autoimmune spectrum patient?
What I usually do is we don't look at exercise in the beginning. What we talk about is getting them functional. I mean, their bodies are already on fire, basically. So we try to reduce that fire. And once it starts going, it's receding, it may not be all the way out. I have a three phase where we get them moving. If they've been sedentary, we just start moving in whatever way is comfortable for them. Once they get moving, get comfortable with the idea that they don't sit all the time, that they do have to keep their body active. Then we try to find an activity that they like. It may be something they did as a child. It may be something that they've always wanted to explore, whatever it is. Then we get them moving on that activity. And once they realize that their bodies are healthy enough to deal with that activity, then we just want them to play with it. We just want them to keep going. And then they start exploring other things. And eventually it works out being exercise, whether they're riding a bike every day or playing tennis,
swimming,
or whatever. They're back to being functional.
Right, right. And having fun with it. Angela, thank you so much for being on the show today.
Thank you so much, Carl. It was a pleasure being here.
It was fun. It was fun. And we created some new jargon for the medical industry and practitioners to use, right?
Autoimmune spectrum. I love it.
Yeah, it's good stuff. All right, look, that's it for today. It's Friday. I'm off tomorrow. Everybody's off tomorrow. It's snowing bad here. I'm getting home before I get caught in the snow. We'll see everybody Monday. We got great shows for you next week. Be here.